Hei, du hører nå på en podcast fra Litteraturhuset I Trondheim.
Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Welcome to the House of Literature here in Trondheim in a joint hosted event by Civita and the House of Literature. My name is Erik Løkke and I will be this evening's moderator. It's nice to have some music also, but maybe it will be turned off as I speak. We have titled this event, How Should Norway Tackle the Terrorist Threat from ISIS? And just at the start of the year, this year, ISIS managed to sort of take down the Norwegian government, or yeah, sort of, by the fact that the FRP, the Progress Party, left the government, blaming the other party's willingness to welcome home a woman who had joined ISIS and her children. The particular case, though, illustrates several dilemmas and challenges. Does ISIS volunteers constitute a serious risk? And is our current terror law tough enough? And what kind of moral and legal responsibility has the Norwegian society for Norwegian-born foreign fighters? And how can we prevent Norwegians from being radicalized and joining ISIS or other terrorist organizations? These are some of the questions we will discuss this evening. And to join me in this conversation, I have invited two excellent speakers, Iyad El-Baghdadi, human rights activist and author, among other things. He's also a colleague of mine at Civita. Sofie Høgestøl, associate professor, Scandinavian Institute of Maritime Law at the University of Oslo. She's also the co-author of the book Foreign Fighters, Prevention, Prosecution, and Rehabilitation in Scandinavia. Is that a correct translation?
I think so.
Excellent. But before I start the conversation, just a short note on practical matters. I will lead this conversation for around 50 minutes. Then we will open up for Q&As, comments, questions. So if you want to take the floor, give me a sign and I will add you on the speakers list. Remember to present yourself and to be brief, and I will have some help with the microphone. So please speak into it so everybody can listen to what is said. We will end no later than 9 o'clock. Feel free to share your thoughts on social media. We have a hashtag, CivitaKveld, but do remember to put your phone on a silent mode. I would also like to make you aware of the emergency exit. I certainly hope we don't need it, but if we do need it, it's out where you came from. And we have restrooms both to the left and to the right. Well, I think that is so much for the practical matter. So I just think we'll start the conversation. And Iyad, let me start with you. And just to give some background of what we're talking about when we're talking about ISIS. I mean, it's a word and a label that's used all the time. If you very briefly should say something about the background for ISIS, where does it come from and what are their core beliefs?
I think we should address the elephant in the room first, given my surname is El-Baghdadi.
Weren't you killed somewhere?
Well, thankfully, I'm the only Baghdadi now. I used to be the second most famous Baghdadi. Now I'm the only one. ISIS is really a creation of the Iraq War. It started, I mean, there's theories, many theories about how it started, but ISIS is Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. Before that, it was just ISI, the Islamic State of Iraq. In the Saddam years, before 2003, there wasn't really much of a presence of a jihadist presence in Iraq. Except far north, there were Kurdish, there was basically a lot of different Kurdish groups. And if you remember, there was an internationally approved, actually American implemented zone to the north of Iraq and to the south of Iraq where there was limited, the Iraqi army had limited operation capacities there. And as a result, there were some jihadist groups, and in fact, they were the first hit in 2003 when the invasion of Iraq happened. Basically, was cruise missiles targeting these camps. However, we would keep in mind that ISI had a different the you know the jihadist presence in Iraq was kind of different from it has a different ideological strain from that of Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is really a child of the Afghanistan war. Famously, of course, it was led by bin Laden. Bin Laden, before the Iraq war, gave a speech. And in that speech, he was actually giving instructions to people he called them our brothers in Iraq. It was not clear at the time whether they had operational capacities in Iraq or not. But in the turmoil that came right after the Iraq war, and this is something that we've seen after the Iraq war so many different times, that whenever there's a breakdown in control, when there's an area where there isn't a lot of government, there's no government structure, it is easy for these kind of groups to actually infiltrate and to set up one of their projects. So not to make it very long, but it's really they managed to consolidate after the Iraq war in Iraq. They had a lot of targets because there were lots of American soldiers to attack and lots of Americans to kill. But also, of course, they were active against other groups. It wasn't only against the Americans, but also against other competing groups, including, of course, the Iraqi government that was set up after that. After 2007 or 2008, there was a move. There were basically an attempt by the Americans to kind of quell the jihadist presence in Iraq. And what they did is that they started to collaborate with tribal councils. They're called the Sahwat councils. These were councils basically of Iraqi tribesmen who were sick and tired of being bullied around by jihadists. A lot of these jihadists were basically foreigners. They weren't Iraqi. A lot of them were Iraqi, but a lot of them were also not Iraqi. And this was highly successful. And so by the end, by around 2009, 2010, before the Arab Spring, we find that a lot of these leaders, the jihadist leaders, were actually in prison, including the leader, the person who later became the caliph, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. So this was the situation before the Syrian uprising. The Syrian uprising, of course, starts in 2011. It escalates into a militant uprising by 2012, 2013. Up till early 2012, we still had a kind of a national opposition, which was the Free Syrian Army, which believed in the idea of Syria. They weren't there to basically to create a new entity. They believed in Syria, and they basically wanted to replace the government in Syria. There was one particular group there that we didn't know much about, and this was a group called Al-Nusra Front. They were mysterious mainly because they never revealed who they really are. They never revealed their ideological direction. And we were only speculating. We didn't know really. They just happened to be very highly effective in battle. So slowly, what happened is that there's even statements by Syrian socialists and leftists who are basically supportive of the Nusra Front. This was, of course, before they revealed who they really are, simply because they were very effective at defeating the Syrian army, the Assad's army, in key battles when Assad's army basically was bulldozing nonviolent protests. It took really all of 2012 and then 2013, I believe it was April 2013, that they revealed who they really were. And they, of course, happened to be associated directly with Al-Qaeda. For a bit of context, ISI, the Islamic State of Iraq that was set up in Iraq, was basically a franchise of Al-Qaeda. Even though they had different leadership, they have different ideology, they have different, they came to jihadism on a different path. But Al-Qaeda was basically the king of the jihadist universe, you can say. And so in order for this little group to actually gain some legitimacy, so there was basically a give and take. So Al-Qaeda gets to say that we have a presence in Iraq, and ISI gets to say we're part of this global movement. So the chaos of post-2013, as the Syrian civil war became increasingly globalized, you have different actors coming in. You had the Russians coming in. You had the Iranians coming in. Hezbollah coming in. It became a proxy war. It became a place where larger powers. So it wasn't about Syrians among themselves anymore. It became about, for example, a battle between the Saudis and the Emiratis and the Qataris and the Iranians and the Russians and Hezbollah, etc. It became a much bigger conflict. And that, of course, gave a big opportunity for ISIS to kind of first infiltrate into the same ranks as the Syrian opposition and later declare war on the Syrian opposition. So instead of being a two-party war between Assad and his opponents, it became Assad, his opponents, and ISIS. Later it became four because the Kurdish parties also kind of pulled out of became their own opposition. In 2014, in the beginning of 2014, there was a big battle between the opposition and between ISIS. And that's when ISIS basically formally split from Al-Qaeda, and we had a formal split in the jihadist movement, which people commented a lot upon at the time. We, as people who are watching jihadism, thought that it's actually dangerous, because whenever you have competition, you have a market. Whenever you have a market, you have competition. The fact that you have two different big players in jihadism is actually, in one way, you're saying that, okay, they're fighting each other, but also it means that they're actually expanding. As a result of that, they ended up capturing a lot of territory from the opposition. And that's when you started to actually create a contiguous map where you can say that this is ruled over by ISIS. And in 2014, in the summer of 2014, they did what was thought impossible, which is that they went back. So they originated in Iraq, and then they found a place in Syria. And in the summer of 2014, thanks to the Iraqi government's ineptitude and corruption, they basically reinvaded Iraq, where they actually started. A lot of the weapons that they got is actually Iraqi government weapons. They captured a lot of weapons from within the military bases that actually took over. And suddenly they became, a really serious force, because now they're running a very large territory. They can make money through oil, because that's an oil-rich region. They can make money through taxation, because they're basically millions of people under their control. Not to mention that, they're running a very successful smuggling business, whether it is, between Iraq and Turkey. Basically, it's a strategic location. And that's when basically it became seen on the map, and that's where they started calling themselves a caliphate, and that's when they started attracting a lot of recruits from across the region. What's interesting is that per capita, if you actually look at, we actually did this research in 2015, 2016, we wanted to see who is joining ISIS, who's coming to join ISIS. So in any jihadist war, whether it is in Yemen or it is in Sinai or it is in, there's always, the majority of fighters are always locals. And the locals are normally fighting for local grievances. They're not ideological. It's someone who basically wants to make money, so he goes and fights because he gets paid. These people, ideologically speaking, they're thugs, of course, but ideologically speaking, they're not actually that committed to the cause. They're not actually committed to the ideology, and we have seen examples. Yesterday there was a story about this person who used to fight for ISIS, and then he fought for Assad. And he died fighting for Assad. So you can see that they're not actually committed so much to the ideology. What was surprising to us is that when we compared the size of the Muslim population of the MENA region to the number of recruits from that country, from those countries, the respective countries, we found that it's actually much higher in Europe. The radicalization route of people who are born and raised in the West is very different, and the profile is very different to people who are actually joining from within the MENA region.
And why is it so attractive for Muslims born in Europe to go to the ISIS?
Well, it's not just Muslims. The thing which is surprising is that there is research done also in 2016 that's found that there's a surprising number of converts to who join ISIS. In some countries, from certain European countries, up to 22% of all people who joined ISIS did not start out Muslim in the first place. There's the case of this young man, I think 17, 18 years old. I think he was 19 years old. He was arrested in Britain, and he had, you know, he was carrying a suitcase, and inside the suitcase were some weapons and a knife, and he wanted to capture and behead an off-duty police officer in the UK. What's amazing about this guy is that 3 weeks before, sorry, 3 months before that, he was not even Muslim. Hmm. Within 3 months, he not only became Muslim, but he joined the very, you know, basically the most extreme outcast, you know, cult, which is rejected by most Muslims. So this is the question here. Why is this so attractive? Mm. I mean, whether we're talking about people who are nihilistic or people who are, you know, simply attracted to this vision. A problem when we do this research is that a lot of the information. So there are certain well-known cases that we can actually study, but there are lots of cases that intelligence people know about and they can't reveal the details for, you know, for legal reasons. But what we see is a lot of people who were losers, really, in their own society. Mm. People who are alienated, a lot of people who are very, very young. I mean, there are people who joined ISIS as 15 years old, 16 year old, etc. I certainly worked with our friend Asna Sajda on her book, Two Sisters. And of course, the two sisters. One of them was actually 16. She was a child when she actually joined when she traveled to Syria. The main drivers for a lot of radicalization really is questions of belonging, of purpose, and of identity. These are the big questions, and these are questions which normally happen. I mean, when people are questioning these things, they're normally in very young, or normally they're not well adjusted in society. It's rare to find people who join these groups when they're old, when they're like in their 40s or 50s. It happens, it's not unheard of, but you know, it's kind of rare.
But the motivation is kind of what you would expect then. All of this makes kind of intuitive sense, doesn't it?
It does, but you know, like they're competing theories here, of course, but you know, if you can't be the winner in a society, if you can't be the villain, if you can't play the hero, you kind of want to play the villain, right? Mm. I mean, and again, when we speak about these factors, when we speak about personal push and pull factors for why people join these kind of groups, it doesn't take away from the severity of their crimes. And so when we say, for example, we're trying to understand why they did this so that we can identify the reason, so that we can fix our societies, it doesn't mean that we're excusing or justifying what they did. We're simply basically saying that, you know, even when people drift into crime, there's reasons for why they do that, because this is abnormal behavior. It's not supposed to happen. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, the broader, as I said, the broader questions really is this. But also, I think there was a big number of people who we would call entrepreneurs. What I mean by entrepreneurs is that they were attracted to the project of a new society. And I wonder if we had functioning leftist parties, and we were talking earlier today about this, whether marginalized people, people who feel marginalized or people who feel outcast, I'm sorry, whether they would prefer to join a leftist cause rather than a nihilistic far right cause, because that's the way that, I mean, as an Arab Muslim, the way that I look at these groups is that we look at them as more nationalistic than theological, because really it's an identitarian movement. They wanted to create a nation state where citizenship is defined, basically your citizenship is basically defined by your religion, and of course one very particular kind of strand of religion. So there are lots of questions to ask. It's not just about personal factors, but it's really political factors here. Mm. The failure of the left to attract these marginalized people, to basically say that, you know, these are the people who would normally be attracted to these kind of causes, I think that's a question to for all of us to ponder.
That's very interesting. Sophia, with your legal background, in a legal way, how should we combat this threat? I mean, there are a lot of political, psychological motives there, but just let me start by asking you your opinion if the terrorism law in Norway is tough enough. Are there enough tools to combat this through legal means in Norway?
Yeah, I think the simple and short answer to that question is yes. I think that the last 5 years have shown that the Norwegian Terror Code is up to scratch when it comes to prosecuting these cases, because Norway has been, you know, particularly in a Scandinavian perspective, we have prosecuted more in foreign fighters cases than, you know, most other Scandinavian countries. And so if you look to our neighbor Sweden, for example, Sweden did not criminalize the act of participating in a terrorist organization. Norway criminalized that in 2013. And this means that it was already illegal when most people traveled to Syria to start participating in the Islamic State. It was already a crime under Norwegian law. And so where Sweden has been in the situation where when people return to Sweden, there are no laws, concrete laws, that they have broken by participating in the Islamic State.
But have they defined which are the terrorist groups?
Norwegian law does not define what a terrorist group is. And so that is up to the judge in any given case. And that's partly why you've seen cases really only concentrated around persons who participated in the Islamic State and also individuals who participated in the Nusra Front that you spoke about. But we also took an additional step in 2016, which is what got me interested in this field of research when we first proposed this law in 2014, 2015, and that is that we've actually made it illegal to participate in all forms of military groups abroad. And so Norwegian prosecutors no longer have to restrict themselves to prosecuting individuals who have participated in terrorist groups like ISIS, but they can also prosecute persons who have participated in groups that are more gray area groups upon their return. And I think we're one of the few Western countries that have taken that step.
Does that mean that people joining the Kurdish forces fighting ISIS in Syria will be prosecuted?
Potentially.
Well, some say they should get a medal rather than prosecuted.
Yes, and the Kurdish question was a big part of the debate when Norway was considering whether or not to criminalize this in 2016. Because a lot of people felt that, you know, someone traveling to Syria and Iraq to fight for Kurdish forces is something completely different than traveling to Syria and Iraq to...
Quite obviously, don't you
think? Quite obviously. Nevertheless, we decided to criminalize the act of participating in military groups. But from a legal perspective, I think the interesting question is that the exception to this is if you participate in a state-like entity. Oh. So if you can argue that the Kurdish army is a state-like entity, or if it's, some would argue that it's a part of the Iraqi or a sort of a branch of the Iraqi army, then you can try and argue that in court, and then you cannot be prosecuted. So, I think Norway tried to principally criminalize everyone equally who participates in these groups, but they have left certain little legal gaps open that would mean potentially that persons returning to Norway who have fought for Kurdish forces will not be prosecuted. But I know for a fact, or it's been reported in the media, that PST, our security forces, have actually been in contact with persons who have fought for certain Kurdish groups and said, you know, you are risking prosecution upon return to Norway. Mm. So we might see cases in the future.
But how are the possibilities or the limits to actually prosecute foreign fighters, given the fact that Norway has no jurisdiction? It's very difficult to know what they actually done. Of course, you mentioned that just being a member of ISIS or a terrorist group in itself would constitute prosecution. But I mean, there's also the fact that some of them may have done illegal things, and have Norway any legal tools to prosecute?
So we have been much better than Sweden in actually criminalizing participating in a terrorist organization, which means that we've had many more cases. But Sweden has been better than Norway when it comes to prosecuting cases on the basis of war crimes. Because, you know, from a legal perspective, you get about 4 to 6 years in prison if you've participated in the Islamic State. You can get up to 30 years in prison under Norwegian law if you've participated in a war crime. And so those two things are not equal. But Norway has yet to really prosecute anyone on the basis of a war crime or crime against humanity or genocide. So we don't have a lot of experience with that. We have the laws now to do so, but we haven't actually done so yet. And Sweden, because they haven't criminalized participating in a terrorist organization, they have actually had to have a few cases where they have prosecuted persons for committing war crimes. But those were individuals who were dumb enough to take pictures of their war crimes and then take them back with them to Sweden and keep them in their apartments. One is not so lucky with everyone who's participated in Syria. And that is why the Swedish state was able to prosecute them without those photos. Mm. There wouldn't be an evidentiary basis for those cases. And I think what you're probably going to see is that we don't think about this now, but we are still prosecuting cases from the Yugoslav wars in the 90s. We're still prosecuting cases from Rwanda, which also happened in the 90s. And I think that you're going to see Syrian cases also be prosecuted over, not in a five-year perspective, but in a decade perspective. So I think that if you, there might be situations now where people return back to Norway or Sweden or Denmark, and the national prosecution authorities cannot prosecute them based on the evidence of the time. However, there is no term limits for war crimes. So if in 5 or 10 years there is some sort of functioning evidential collection situation in Syria, then you could see prosecutions in 10 years or 5 or 10 years when that time comes.
And how important is for Norway, you mentioning Sweden, but other European countries in terms of different legal system? Should there be any approach to harmonizing legal system or even get a international criminal court of some sort to prosecute? Is it possible?
My specialty is international criminal courts, and I think a lot of people in my field would like to see an international criminal court in Syria. But I think the biggest hindrance, the practical hindrance to having such a court, is that it would require Security Council authorization. And who sits in the Security Council? Russia. They are not going to authorize an international criminal court given the present day situation. And I also think that if you look at the Syrian conflict, because as you said, there are so many different state actors who have been in the Syrian civil war in some way or another. They are all powerful states. They are not necessarily going to want to see an international criminal court with a mandate to try all of those actors.
There's another point, which is that each of these actors have committed war crimes.
Exactly. I mean, I think that while there's still more to know about the crimes that have been committed in Syria, we know enough at this point to say with some certainties that most actors have participated in war crimes. And that means that there are many people and many people with strong, powerful interests in not having such a court, not least Assad. Mm. I cannot see Assad wanting to create an international criminal court that he himself could be prosecuted by. Mm.
Let me ask you, you've seen this from Norway, and what's your view on the way that Norway or other European countries are its approach to foreign fighters' prosecution? Are they done a fairly good job, or should they change their approach?
I mean, for a while, especially the British and the French, they didn't want them back. In fact, they wanted...
That's understandably.
They wanted to make sure that they're killed in the theater of war. So in fact, or handed over to the Iraqi army, because the Iraq basically has a death sentence, and they basically kill people who have committed these kind of crimes. And so... Maybe it's me. And so they're basically sending their own commandos to kill their own foreign fighters in the theater of war, so that they don't have to actually worry about prosecuting them back home, because of the legal challenges. So you mentioned evidence, and of course this is very important. The thing that worries me here is that, I mean, there is actually a lot of documentation, because there's lots of local journalists. Or local, really, citizen groups in all across the region which was occupied by ISIS, who have documented everything. They have taken videos. They've taken hours and hours and hours of video. There's even an archive. I think there's something online called the Syria Archive, which basically just archiving videos, with the understanding that one day, someone's going to take a look at the video and decide, we're going to prosecute people on this behalf. The problem is that, of course, first of all, there's no where do you even try these people? I mean, if you want to follow the principle of trying them where they committed their crime, there's no legal system there. There's no effective legal system in place in Syria, and in Iraq, Iraq is still in turmoil. And of course, Iraq is gripped by its own protest movement right now, mainly motivated again by lack of services and corruption, the same factors that actually led to the rise of ISIS in the first place. As you mentioned, the idea of an international tribunal is really what's needed. What's really needed is an international tribunal. Even more than that,
a truth and reconciliation commission.
But you know, we're I think a decade away from that, if not more. But again, I mean, that path is blocked. So the question really becomes, I mean, it's almost a perfect legal storm here. What are you going to do with these people? Because if you're going to say we're going to throw these people back to Syria and Iraq, I think these countries have suffered enough. And, you know, like, if you want to treat these people as the trash of your society, then every country has to pick up its own trash rather than just dump its trash into Syria and Iraq.
Mm. How many people are we actually talking about as foreign fighters? Is there a number?
Several hundred. Foreign fighters.
I mean, the total number of foreign fighters was exaggerated. I think in 2015, 2016, we're talking about over 10,000. But I think later on we found that the number is overly exaggerated. A lot of them, you know, fortunately for everyone, died in battle. Or died basically during the campaign, so they never survived. We do have a really, really painful situation right now because eventually, a lot of ISIS families, of course, also include children who are, you know, basically innocent, but also including refugees that just happened to be living in these areas. Eventually, were basically moved into refugee camps, into, you know, IDP camps. And a lot of them are basically treated, all of them are treated as if they're ISIS, even though a lot of them are not. A lot of them are victims of ISIS. I believe there's a number of Norwegians there as well, in Al-Hul camp. I think the two sisters that were cited by Osna in her book are also there.
Yes.
I believe there are three Norwegian women there. Mm. Three Norwegian women.
But do we know how many Norwegian foreign fighters?
I think all of the men have died.
Well, I think that the numbers, the latest numbers from PST is around max 10 to 20. But I think...
I heard seven.
Yeah, I think that if we, you know, those most of the men have not been heard from or seen in a very long time.
And they have no incentives to give so much sound?
Probably not. Probably not. So if we're left,
but
the
we're
women,
talking
we're talking
about manageable people to prosecute in Norway if you have the political will.
I think you mentioned France. I was in France quite a bit last year because my
I mean, I want to put
my partner.
Because what does the law say about someone who basically left as a minor?
But this is an interesting legal question. In Norway, you are, in terms of the criminal code, you're an adult at 15. You can be tried for crimes at 15. So no one left under the age of 15. Having said that, to me, there's also a difference between if you left at 16, you were a minor. You should never have been in a position to be able to leave for Syria.
Exactly.
That needs to be factored in, and it would be interesting to see how a court would factor that the age question in upon sentencing, because that's probably when you would factor in age as an issue. Because 16 is very young, and we know that, you know, some of the more famous UK cases of young girls who left, they were also around that age. And that doesn't get spoken about enough as an issue. But you mentioned France, and I was in France quite a bit a year ago because my partner was working there. And I was following the French national debate, and obviously France has hundreds of foreign fighters. And at the time, you know, France was seriously considering behind the scenes to just bring everyone home from a security perspective because they're sort of stuck in that limbo of, do we leave them where they are and risk them coming home through different routes as a security threat, or do we actually just say, okay, we're going to have to bring people home, it's a more secure setting to do so, so let's actually start that process. However, I think most European countries have found that it's been politically completely impossible to have an open discussion about, you know, the bringing a lot of people home. But, you know, in terms of France, we're talking about hundreds of persons, and France has had difficulties with people getting radicalized in prison. So obviously there are many issues there. We don't have those issues. We probably have, as you say, around 7-8 adults who are alive in these camps. And so it's a much more manageable number. And that's in that sense, Norway is in a more fortunate position than other countries. Because unlike Sweden, I think Sweden has been sort of the, they are the ones who are suggesting that we should create a European, internationally led court for to prosecute ISIS. And that's partly because they don't have the legal framework for doing those prosecutions domestically. So for Sweden, if you bring everyone home, that is going to be a problem. Whereas, at least for us, we have a legal framework and we've done a lot of these cases now. We know that, you know, the fact of the matter is most of these individuals, if not all of them, are already under international arrest warrants.
Mm. Well, you mentioned minors and children, and obviously it got a lot of attention, the case with the women and the children who was brought back earlier this year, if it was not late last year, but some months ago. And do we know how many children, Norwegian children or other children, who are in the area?
I think PST is being very careful to say that they say children with Norwegian affiliations, because not everyone has a Norwegian or would be capable of getting a Norwegian passport. Some of the children are born from mothers who were in Norway on a permanent residenceship, but they were not Norwegian citizens. And so there's a question as well, how do you define what being a Norwegian child in this situation is? If you go by citizenship, I think maybe 10 to 20 children.
And what does the law say about, the Norwegian law say about Norwegian children stuck outside? Do we have a legal responsibility for them?
This is a question that you could write a PhD on in law, because it's not quite clear. It's a gray area where I think there's been, my position is that I can't point to any specific law in Norway and say that that law means that you're entitled to the Norwegian state coming to get you. Because there's two different questions there. The idea of everyone has the right to return home. You know, if any of these children come to Norwegian borders, we obviously have to take them. They are Norwegian citizens. But there's another, the legal question then becomes, do you have an active right to be taken home, that your state flies down and gets you out? And I can't, at present, I haven't been convinced that there's a single law in Norway that gives you that kind of a right. And so to me, if you ask me, then my conclusion is probably that you do not have an active right to be taken home.
Mm. But do we have a morally obligation to bring them home?
Well, of course. I mean, they're kids.
Yeah.
And I'll just mention what happened to one of the kids who was born to a British mother. And the British mother was basically stripped of British citizenship last year. And I think she had, he was under 1 year old. It was an Al-Hol camp, and the boy froze to death. I don't think anybody. I think if we are okay with that, then who's the terrorists? I mean, who's evil here? I mean, if we're okay with what's happening to these children, from dying of cold or being raped or being brutalized or being raised in that camp, we're really raising another generation of ISIS fighters, really.
I think that's the. I mean, having said that, there's no active legal obligation, it's not the same as saying we shouldn't go in.
Yeah.
Because I think that's sort of been the some Norwegian politicians have said, well, do we even have a right to go in and get them out? And it's like, the situation has been all along that these are the jihadists and children that no one wants. There's no one claiming a right to keep them. So we have been free to go in and get them, I think, pretty much for a year or 2 years. That's been the situation. And I think it goes to this question it is a moral question, which is why I think it's a question that is so divisive, in public.
Yeah, but I mean...
thing to speak about the adults, but it's a totally different question when I speak about children.
Yeah, and I mean, most people and politicians
just
say
just
that...
Just keep in mind, a lot of these kids were actually born there.
Mm.
The war really, it started, the caliphate basically was declared in 2014. So we're talking about 6 years. So we're talking about very young children.
Mm. But do you think that the European countries should do more to get the children home? I mean, there are some obstacles. Certainly the Norwegian foreign government says that they don't have jurisdiction. Yeah. It isn't just to take a plane and get them home.
And
there are some obstacles.
I think this is the sort of interesting, sensitive issue that is hard to grapple with from a practical perspective now. And that is that, after having given this a lot of thought, the Norwegian government has concluded that you cannot simply go in and forcibly remove kids from their parents or from their mother in this situation. We don't have the legal grounds to do so. And that was also sort of a gray area. Can we do that? And I think that what you saw when the foreign minister came out and she said that we're getting home the sick kid, the reason she gave for that was precisely, and why they were bringing the mother back was because we can't legally separate them. Because that's also a human. That also is a human right. You know, the right to a right. to family life and family relations.
Right.
So that makes that question very difficult. Because if it was just a question of orphans, orphan Norwegian citizens, I think they would all be home by now.
Right.
The legally and the politically sensitive issues. How do we bring home the parents? And I think that's where you see. Most European countries have not been willing to go that extra step. They've been fine with bringing home orphans, but bringing home actual adults, that has been politically not salient in most countries.
I mean, there's a question, though. I mean, I would pose it to you because I'm not clear about the legality of it. But it seems to me that these children are going to be fostered out anyway.
Yep.
Because their parents are not really suited,
yep.
not legally suited to actually raise children anyway.
I totally understand, I hear this a lot, you know, seriously, you know, these are must be the worst parents ever. I have a 17-year-old little brother, and I tell him all the time, you should be so fortunate we didn't take you to Syria. You know, when he complains about, you know, not having more pocket money or, you know, having to do his homework, I'm like, you're not in Syria. I think you're doing very well. But it's a question of, I think, it actually, to me, boils down to a series of events. You know, it is the state, these are not in adults who haven't been put in prison yet. And then we don't, you know, the Norwegian state can't just simply go in and take your child away without having had that.
It's a
legal process. And if we open for that, we're also sort of lessening all of our parents' rights. I don't know if I want to open for the Norwegian state to be able to come and take my child, you know, easier without due process, without a legal process. So it's this question of due process that comes in.
But it's quite prima facie obvious that, as mentioned, they're probably the worst children ever. If you brought your child or had a child in within the ISIS caliphate, that kind of makes it easier to prove in a court of law that you're unsuited.
Probably, but that has to happen before you can lose custody.
Is that process going on with the women who returned?
But she's now in prison. Mm. The woman who's returned is now in prison and. So she's not with her children.
It seems to me, I mean, if I would summarize that, in order to bring the children home, you have to bring the parents and prove that the parents are, unfit to be parents.
And I think that's where most European states, they have, you saw France as well, took home orphans. But that extra step of taking home, especially mothers, I think it's been really interesting to watch how the debate, particularly around the women, has sort of really, really divided society. You know, who are these women? Were they fooled? You know, like, are they just mothers? Are they terrorists? What are they? I think that most European countries have had exactly the same debate that we had a few months ago in Norway.
Very soon we'll open up for Q&A, so I'll notice around. So give me a sign by lifting your finger if you want to take the floor. But before we move on, I just also want to move on to ask what kind of security threats. The impression is that ISIS is more or less beaten, but I mean, how do you beat an ideology of jihadism? So, in your view, what kind of threat does ISIS or other jihadist groups pose for Europe in the years to come?
Well, I mean, the radicalization problem has metastasized. It's wider than ISIS. Because we're looking at white nationalist terrorist networks as well, and they're very concerning, mainly because Russia, Putin, is very interested in them, and because there's more a chance for them to grow. They don't have, like, white nationalist groups do not have a unified ideology. If they do, then we have a problem. When it comes to ISIS as a threat, ISIS became a huge threat because, as I mentioned, it ruled enough territory to have its own resources. Basically, it was functioning as if it's a proto-state. What they did after that is that they reverted to their pre-state, function, which was basically insurgency. As insurgents, of course, they're less effective. They're still in operation, but they're less effective, and they're more local. It seems that the future of jihadism, I mean, this is something that there's a researcher by the name of Hassan, who wrote a lot about this, and he's basically comparing the evolution of Al-Qaeda in Syria and the evolution of ISIS, and how ISIS basically has been beaten, while Al-Qaeda in northern Syria are kind of still have some kind of presence. It's because they managed, Al-Qaeda managed to ingratiate themselves to local politics, local conflicts, local contexts. They became a local movement. ISIS did not do that. ISIS basically was an occupation force for most of, you know, when you... So, I mean, I could be wrong, but I don't think we're... Even when it comes to the lone wolf attacks that happened, that ISIS used to take credit for, in many cases, there were not actually lone wolf attacks in a sense that it wasn't that ISIS actually supplied or created the context for the attack. It's just someone basically goes and shoots up a gallery or shoots up a bar, etc., but then records a video before that saying, "I pledge allegiance to ISIS." So it's not like ISIS actually created the terror attack, but it's basically created a situation where it can take credit for it. If analysis by people like Hassan is true, then what we're going to see is that these jihadist groups are going to try to become more local than global. The global image basically gives them an image that they're everywhere, and they're bigger than they are, and they're more dangerous than they are. And that actually wins them more recruits, which wins them more donations, which more funds, etc. But of course, security is very important. And I would mention actually that returnees, if we're talking about male returnees who have a militant background coming back, they are a security threat. They absolutely are a security threat, even in prison. As you mentioned, there's basically prison radicalization, prison recruitment, etc. And even if European countries don't have death sentences, which means that you'll have to keep these people forever, and if you keep them in prison, they're going to develop more ideologies or whatever. So they are absolutely a threat. But the terror threat that actually scares me, if I look at the rest of the 21st century, it is if white nationalist networks develop a unifying ideology and find common cause, they find a good sponsor who would provide them with money, training, and a target list. And that's kind of what Putin is looking at.
Yeah. Just, I think, for me, the interesting part of this phenomenon has been that Norway has been a really big diplomatic champion of international criminal law. You know, we have been such an important part in building international criminal courts. I think what's been interesting for me is that all of a sudden, Norway, through these foreign fighters, have had to deal with questions of how do you integrate and deal with persons who have committed atrocity crimes. That is not something we've had to deal with since the Second World War, from private citizens. And so it's kind of been interesting that, we've been very good at traveling abroad and saying, do these trials, reconciliation, rehabilitate your child soldiers, justice, do this. And then all of a sudden, we have to deal with those questions. And those questions are really, really difficult questions. And I think for me, building on what you said, the important thing is that this is not, a singular phenomenon. ISIS, the idea of Norwegians joining an organization like ISIS is not a singular phenomenon. We know for a fact that there are European nationals who have traveled to the Ukraine to fight for far-right nationalist groups who are involved in the Ukraine conflict. We know that for a fact. And so I think that the Norwegian approach to this should be a long-term perspective one, which is what signals and what standards are we developing in the way that we meet foreign fighters in Syria, and how are we going to develop a standard that we can also apply in the future? And so if you ask me from a criminal perspective, I think there's quite an important signal to send that if you travel abroad as a Norwegian, and you participate in mass atrocities, war crimes, genocide, and the likes, the Norwegian state will prosecute you. You cannot think that you're going to travel abroad and do those things and be able to run around the world scot-free and participate in other organizations. And I think that is something I think we have to think about a little bit more, because that's an important signal to send, because I don't think this ends.
I would add a point about the people who went to fight for the Kurdish groups, and we know that the Syrian Democratic Forces eventually, like you mentioned, that if it's a government entity, the Syrian Democratic Forces eventually became a governance structure, and they're administering basically a third of Syria. The Syrian Democratic Forces, again, were Kurdish dominated. They were not only Kurdish, but Kurdish dominated, but they were the best of... I mean, everybody has committed terrible things in that war, but the SDF were really the most democratic, and the less brutal of all of the groups. That said, I think anybody going to join an active civil war is adding fuel to the fire. I think it's wrong, and I think it should be criminalized.
As it now is, yeah.
But Sophia, you mentioned you spent quite some time in France.
Yeah.
And France has increased their fight against terrorism and made tougher terrorism laws. Some say it's been effective, basically cracking down on recruit sites on the internet and so on. Is that something we should learn from in Norway as well?
Perhaps, but I think that, you know, we go back to these push and pull factors for why someone is radicalized. And I think that we have to really look at, you know, we had a terrorist attack in Norway this summer with the mosque incident. Thankfully, no one was killed in the mosque. He did, kill his adopted sister. And I think what we still, that case is going to come to trial soon, so we will learn more about his radicalization process. But what we know so far is that radicalization process seemed to have happened very quickly. However, there were individuals who contacted PST about him. You know, how are we better in our communities of identifying these radicalization processes so people don't become so radicalized that they commit these crimes? I think that's the really long-term difficult question, and that
fighting the root causes.
Yeah,
that's
and I mean,
that's,
you know,
the big question.
We can come with the legal. We can look at the legal framework. But if we don't do anything with those radicalization causes,
if we wait until it becomes a legal problem, we've waited.
We waited too long, and I think that has to be the longer term debate. Is how we work with communities, local communities, in that fight against radicalization.
But my impression is that people are doing this all the time. Aren't we doing this enough? From your perspective, Iyad, what are you lacking in terms of addressing these issues of radicalization before it comes to legal problems?
I think
what
we really
exactly
need to we need to understand radicalization. I think radicalization really is a reflection of our innate tribalism. Human beings, I mean, I tell people that Homo sapiens as a species were tribal even before they became Homo sapiens. I mean, even our pre-Homo sapiens ancestors were also tribal. And there's something about us kind of reverting to that kind of, you know, intense tribalism, where it became, when, you know, being a member of a group, we can completely dehumanize and completely, you know, recklessly hate people who are of a different group. All we have to do is basically otherize them and to say that, you know, you are of one group, we are of another group, and I have to defend my group because you're attacking my group. This is a human problem; it's always going to be there, and the response really is a stronger society. So it's, again, I mean, just like you said, it's a question about the very foundation of our societies. It's not a trivial question, and it should not only be a security question.
Yep.
It's really a foundational question.
But it maybe also should be, because probably no matter how hard you try, you're always going to have people who tend up to follow that biology of being radicalized, and so you also need legal tools.
I mean, to be honest, I mean, maybe this was missing from my biography when you introduced me, but I was radicalized before. I was radicalized after the Iraq War. Thankfully, I was de-radicalized. I mean, or I de-radicalized myself. So I have a first-person perspective on what it means to be radicalized and then de-radicalized. And since part of my job is to help de-radicalize people, I have to believe that you can de-radicalize people. So I have to believe that no matter, you know, that no human being is a lost cause. We're not fortunate, and we're not naive to think that it's always the case. I mean, some people are lost causes, unfortunately. But we have to assume that in order for us to build that kind of structure in our societies.
Yeah.
And Sophia, your impression from a legal or political perspective, how well do you think Norway is doing the issue of fighting radicalization? I mean, you mentioned the case of the summer and right-wing white nationalism attack. Again, I think maybe you should step out fighting white nationalism, or how do you see it? What should we do better?
I think this is a big question that you can spend your life trying to figure out. But I think that it's, you know, with practically what's happening now, I think it's a positive thing that PST, for example, is now doing a critical review of how they handled the Monsa case. Why did they receive a tip? Why didn't that tip like why wasn't that taken further? I mean, it's very, very, we know how difficult it is to work in this murky field of radicalization and, you know, the push and pull of when you sort of try and make an intervention. But I think that really trying to map out how we can work on these issues more systematically. But also, I think, you know, as you said, this is a community question to me as well. And how we work within our communities to prevent radicalization. You know, I've thought about that a lot myself. I mean, we've had that discussion. A lot of the people who left for Syria, for example, they were part of quite a radical group at Oslo Met. You know, what could you have done, you know, with what we've learned today, what could you have done in that context to help to start a de-radicalization process? I think if you figure that out, you know, you can. There are many, many international awards to be had, I think.
Yeah, but I noticed two interventions from the audience. I will very soon give you the floor, but just to follow up on that one, because I think it's important, because everything in hindsight is easier.
Absolutely, absolutely.
The main difference in example between Norway and Russia is that Russia is a much more authoritarian state, probably has more tools to combat terrorism in ways we do not want to go.
Yeah.
So I also heard a discussion about if the PST should have stopped Breivik before.
Yeah.
But I mean, if they had the tools to do that, we are moving very much.
I think. I think this is the really difficult legal balance, is that, you know, if you expand, I think that's one of the bigger legal debates of our time, is if you expand the toolbox for surveillance, you know, for the police to go into these cases, you're also eroding the foundational values of our society, you know, human rights. And it's like finding that tipping point, that balancing point between human rights on the one side and giving the police and the security forces the tools they need to combat radicalization and extremism. Finding that balance is really, really difficult, and I think it's going to be one of the key questions of our time, and it has been since 9/11.
I would mention, Eirik, that in the case of a lot of authoritarians, it's by design.
Yeah.
I mean, you give your country a touch of terrorism so that you can rule it forever in the name of fighting terrorism.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Please. Yeah, I had a question for Sofia. You said that we should have a long-term perspective, that Norway should have a long-term perspective.
Yeah.
Does that mean that you think we should go and get them back?
I wrote an op-ed in Aftenposten in March last year where I said I agree with Trump, which is that Trump's recommendation is that European countries take back their own nationals and prosecute them domestically. And I think that because Norway has proven that they can do these cases and we have quite a small number of people, I think that on balance, if you ask me from a criminal perspective, I think that's maybe the best solution on the table right now. So yes.
And are there any politicians willing to, or do you see any movement?
Yeah, I feel like there have been really no politicians who listened to that op-ed. You know, strangely enough, it is a really, really difficult question. I think if you look at in Europe as well, the idea, I think that was what was interesting with being in France at the start of 2019, was that at some point, French media reporting that the French government internally were like, okay, we think that in terms of the terrorism threat, the best thing to do is maybe bring them home because we can control the process. But politically speaking, when people found out, when that leaked out to the press, people were protesting. And the same happened in Finland. So I think that it's a question of politicians, but also, you know, it's a really difficult political question. But I do think that it's going to be difficult for the Norwegian state to justify bringing home one child and leaving the rest of the children that we know where they are. I think that I'm very interested to see what will happen in the next few months.
Yes. Could I give some kind of two comments? The first one about the factors or the motivation, which, yeah, the motivations, me? Yeah, no? Yeah.
About the factors. We need to understand it's like what we call push and pull. It's socially, economically, and politically. And we need to understand, we ask ourselves why a person, like from European they try to focus and repeat what Trump said about the people suffering there. They need help. They need to hand of help. For that, some people, as activists, as a humanist, they thinking how we can go and help people there. That's fair. Second, we need to understand how this path or these gates from Norway to Iraq or Aleppo be opened. Why it's open was open to go and it's closed to back. Okay? We need to ask ourselves that Erdogan, the partner of a lot of European countries in that area at that time, especially he's a member of NATO, he closed one eye for the path of terrorists or the fighters to go inside Syria and Iraq. And I will share something. A lot of that, it's beside of Algeria. It's a very important NATO Air Force base. The people just walk around to go inside the Syrian border. That's all. Economically, I would like to share something about what we call what they call it in Iraq and Syria. They call it the foreigner fighters. We call it al-muhajirin, or what is it? They call it migrants. The migrant fighter have the high positions, the high salaries, the leadership, the good houses, the good cars and vehicles, and I'm sorry to share the bad things also, the good women, the best slaves, they keep it for the foreigners fighters. It's a kind of motivation. If I would like to share about the salaries, the foreigner fighters got the high salaries. If I will give an example, for example, the local fighters, he will take around $100 to maximum $500 a month. For foreigner fighters, it's around $5,000 to $10,000 a month. It's a job. That what I would like to socially.
Just have to close now.
Yeah, yes. The last thing about socially, a lot of factors, it pushes we people, you are not of one of us, okay? This country, this civilization, this culture, you are not one of us. For that, try to find in a place which you belong. The last things what I would like to say about our parents, our kids, our women, our citizens, ISIS, radicalism, extremism, it's like of disease. It's like Corona now. All countries or government try to evacuate their citizens from China or the bad, the dangerous zones. ISIS or this area also, it's a kind of disease. We have to save or evacuate our child, women, citizen. And when they are here, we can discuss about the factors, reasons, and if they are really victims or they are murderers.
Yeah, thank you for your comments, and there are a lot of things, and I think I'll follow up with one thing wondering about, the recruitment process, the fact that it's open to go down but closed to come back.
Yeah.
How does the professional ISIS recruiters actually work, and how are they successful in bringing people?
A lot of the people went in 2013 and 2014. This is actually legally complicated because in 2013, people who went there in 2013, ISIS did not exist at the time, at least officially. And so when they went in 2013, you can't say that they went to join ISIS because ISIS didn't exist. But it's true that a lot of them, when they left, of course, there were push factors, there were pull factors, but some of, as the gentleman mentioned, it was almost a colonial movement. It's almost like where these people who are, frankly, they might be of immigrant backgrounds, but they are European. They are not Syrian. They're certainly not from Raqqa or from Deir ez-Zor or from any of these areas. So the person who named ISIS Daesh, later found out he's from Raqqa, and he ended up as a refugee in the United Kingdom, and he found out that ISIS family was living in his house. So he became refugee. He's from Raqqa, which became the capital of ISIS, and he became a refugee while basically people from Europe, and he had to go to Europe while actually fighters from Europe are living in his home in Syria. So it's a really messed up situation there. Mm. There was the case of a German immigrant who joined ISIS in 2013, I think, or 2014, and who went there, and he was a member of ISIS for 8 months. He managed to, you know, cross in, and he became, you know, a fighter, and then he was disillusioned, and he tried to flee. He tried several times. Every time they basically shoot at him, he had to, you know, eventually he managed to actually escape, managed to go back to Germany. He had a light sentence. I think he was in prison for 6 months or something like that, mainly because he became very effective in de-radicalization. And we kind of need such success stories. Yeah. I think, unfortunately, it's past that, because the people who actually survived all the way till the end are really, really committed, or they're really crazy. So I don't think there's anyone who's going to fight. There's no foreign fighters going now.
No one has left Norway.
No one is leaving now, because there's no pull factor anymore. It's just that we're dealing with a lot of people who left a long time ago. And we're stuck with the end result of this now.
And with regards to, you said, you know, all the things they got upon arrival, and especially the question of slaves, I think that's why it's so important that you cannot think, as a Norwegian citizen, to my mind, that you can travel to somewhere like Syria and get that package deal, if you will, get money, get paid, get slaves, which is also known as a war crime, you know, from my perspective.
That itself was actually a way to actually attract more
exactly. You know, you cannot think that you can go and do that and not have any consequences when you return to Europe. I think it's incredibly important to send a signal that you will be prosecuted for those crimes. I think there's an ongoing German case, which is really important, against a woman who is alleged to have, she had a Yazidi slave and a young girl, young Yazidi girl, who she left, who died under her care. She left her to die in the sun, and she's being prosecuted for the war crime of murder in Germany right now, and I think that's incredibly important.
Do you hear me?
Yes.
You say nobody's going down there now, but can the conflict move to Libya? And can some jihadists go to, and foreign fighters go to Libya?
That's a very good question.
That is the problem of the sound from that microphone, so I think you have to speak up afterwards, the last gentleman, but the question of Libya.
Libya, of course, has gone through its own evolutions. It did have an ISIS presence, but ISIS presence is defeated so far. So they still have insurgents over there, but it doesn't seem, I mean, given the state, the geopolitical state around Syria right now, around Libya, Libya became a proxy war right now, because you have the UAE and Saudi Arabia supporting one side, and you have actual Turkish groups supporting the other side. There are Syrian mercenaries who fought for Turkey in Syria who are being transported to Libya to fight for, for Turkey in Libya. So I think that the state over there is, like, normally these kind of conflicts, this kind of ISIS presence happens when there's no big countries fighting over a peace. And you know, the upper third of Syria basically was kind of forgotten for a long time. And this is why ISIS managed to establish itself over there. But when it became, you know, we knew from the start, from the time that ISIS basically rose, that the world is going to band together, everybody's going to band together and is going to defeat them. I don't think there's space for them to surge in Libya right now. Although, if there is a place for them that worries me a little bit, I would say Somalia.
Yeah, I was going to say Somalia.
I would say sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah.
And I would say Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Well.
But it's basically places where there are no strong state institutions, where you have a breeding ground for being able to host such an organization and have it develop. So I think the interesting thing is, where do the two sisters want to go? Because we haven't discussed that, but the part of the problem with some of the women, Norwegian women who are left in these camps, is they don't want to go home. Right? They haven't asked for help to come home because they know what's going to happen when they come home. They're going to go to prison. That's what's going to happen. And so the two sisters who are currently in the two sisters that we know from Åse Steinsland's book, they want to go to Somalia. That's the latest development, is that they're looking at ways they could get Somalian citizenships. Their parents are Somalian nationals. So they're looking, they've asked Somalia if they can be extradited.
You have to speak without a microphone, so just speak up. Yeah.
Then.
That's an excellent question to end on. So thank you, sir. Do you, what can we do?
It's a very broad question, and I wrote a lot about this in 2016, 2017 for Aftenposten as well. I think we need to be more skilled at, I think we need to be educated more about radicalization so that we can actually figure out what the warning signs are. And the warning signs actually happen to be social isolation, long before we actually see evidence of militancy. There's basically social isolation, anger. There's an interesting overlap between, I think you might have noticed as well, between domestic abuse and radicalization as well. I mean, a lot of these people also happen to I think the terrorist from earlier, from last year, he was involved in some kind of domestic abuse as well. So I think better relations between communities and between law enforcement is very important, but also having structures, actually having centers. I think every big city has to have a de-radicalization center. And we need to speak more about it. We need to actually not disown the problem, because what happens when, to be honest, I mean, I'm a refugee in Norway, prospective Norwegian. But when I see the debate about this, I see almost a debate, and it just happened that I actually lived in the same house as Åsne Seierstad when she was writing the book, and we spoke a lot about her previous book, One of Us. The main thing about the title, One of Us, about Breivik, is that he is one of us, and that we cannot disown the problem. We have to actually acknowledge that this is a problem that we need to face, and we cannot say these are others, these are other people's problems, and we don't even have to bring them back, we don't even have to think about them, and that's it. I think a psychological barrier that we have to cross is to actually realize that this is a problem everywhere, and this is a problem of every time. It's a human problem, and it's going to be to continue to be a problem. I can imagine in the future that if you want to become radicalized and want to become a terrorist, you don't really need to blow up a lot of stuff, because if you're really smart, then there's a lot of cybercrime that you can do. There's a lot of cyberterrorism that you can do. And you can screw up a lot of things in society if you know how to hack the right devices, for example. The problem is not going away.
But just one of the things you said before we move on to your final words, Sofia, I want to ask Iyad a common claim that Muslims have a particular and even more bigger responsibility to fight jihadists than others do. What do you think about that claim?
I could understand, of course, when you say that it's ridiculous to say that it's the community's responsibility. I think we have, as Muslims, I believe we have a moral responsibility, because these people speak in our name, and we have to be the first to say that, you don't speak for us. And I also believe in activism, and I believe that, as Muslim individuals, we also have to be active in fixing our society and strengthening our society. But I completely understand also that, this is something that I'm saying as a Muslim. I'm not going to point the finger at every ethnic Norwegian when there is an ethnic Norwegian terrorist, for example. I think that's wrong.
So, I mean, this is my perspective as a Muslim. I would say, yes, it is our responsibility. But I would push back if someone says that, you know, you're responsible for terrorism, or you're responsible because this terror attack happened. Mm.
Sophia, your final words.
I think it's a really, really good question. And I thought about it a lot this summer when the terrorist attack happened, because it became public quite quickly that there were friends he had been studying at a high school, and there were friends around him who had reacted to his isolation process, you know, the changes that he'd gone through. And some of them, I think, you know, had reached out and asked for help. And I think it's having other more lower threshold centers, as you said, in every city where you can go to. Because I think the problem that a lot of parents sit with, because, you know, he had his father as well, really struggled, you know, what am I supposed to do? I think that my son is being radicalized. And we don't have a lot of, I think that calling PST on your own son is a big thing to ask of someone to do.
There needs to be
more civil society groups that you can go to. And I work with an organization on that called Platform, which is exactly that, who do this kind of work, where you can call and get help that where you don't feel like you have to call the security police on your friends or on your son. And I think it is about having that individual, feeling that individual responsibility, being aware of your community, and also creating spaces where you can have those dialogues in a way that feels safe for persons who are around people getting radicalized. Because I think it's very un-Norwegian. I think it's a very Norwegian culture to be like, I don't want to, like, I don't know if I would have been able to do that myself, because you don't want to intrude or you don't want to be difficult. And I think it's very un-Norwegian to call the police in that way. And I think it's about, as you say, creating centers where you can have those discussions in a more open way.
I think there's an important point we missed this point, but there's actually an important intersection between mental health and radicalization. A lot of those people who actually went and fought are legitimately psychologically unwell. And I think that's something that we really need to examine.
Mm. Well, I just wanted, before we end, mention that the bar here is open until 11, so you're welcome to stay. Also check out the House of Literature in Trondheim for our future events, and you can also check Civita for our event. So thank you all for coming, and thanks to our excellent speakers.